Good morning, and welcome to the lectionary call-in for April 9th. And this is where two pastors and a layperson gather to discuss the gospel lectionary for the coming Sunday. And this coming Sunday is April 14th. And we're doing our best to be faithful to year B, which puts us on the third Sunday for Easter, I think, is what the conversation will be about. And we're looking at the Gospel of Luke, chapter 24, verses 36 through 48. Here's how it works. The designated lead, that would be me, sends out a list of questions in advance of the call, and we gather on Tuesday around 6:30, where we take about 50 minutes to talk about this passage and those questions, to listen to each other, to encourage each other and challenge each other. And the folks joining me today are
Bill Hall in St. Petersburg, Florida.
John Debevoise in Tampa, Florida.
And I'm Sarah Mickelson. And I'm your leader for this week. So this is a fairly good passage that follows on the heels of the conversation on the road to Emmaus. So I kind of want to put that in the front end of this so that we kind of have a thought about this is what Luke records as happening in the first 24 to 36 hours after the resurrection. At least that's how I read it. Was that how you guys read it?
Yes.
I'm going to read from the New Revised Standard Version, and I'm going to start with Luke 24. And while they were talking about this, Jesus himself stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." And they were startled and terrified and thought that they were seeing a ghost. He said to them, "Why are you frightened? And why do doubts arise in your hearts? Look at my hands and my feet and see that it is I myself. Touch me and see, for a ghost does not have flesh and bones as you see I have." And when he had said this, he showed him his hands and his feet. And while in their joy they were disbelieving and still wondering, he said to them, "Have you anything here to eat?" And they gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it in their presence. And then he said to them, "These are my words that I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms must be fulfilled." Then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures, and he said to them, "Thus it is written that the Messiah is to suffer and to rise from the dead on the third day, and that repentance and forgiveness of sins is to be proclaimed in his name to all nations, beginning from Jerusalem. You are witnesses to these things." And that ends the reading of our passage. Wow. I like that the phrase that he opens with is, "Have you anything to eat?" I think that's, for me, that's hilarious. So last week in our conversation around John 20, and again this week in verse 36, Jesus surprises the disciples with, "Peace be with you." How might this be more than a standard greeting? What do you think, Bill?
First, a quick comment that has struck me this season. There's a richness to the different ways Jesus appears to the disciples after the resurrection. And it has reinforced, I think, more strongly this season than before, how important it was that Jesus appear. He appears in the garden talking to Mary. You noted the Emmaus Road, two disciples now with the rest of the disciples, and then there are other appearances. So this is yet another part of the richness of Jesus's appearance narratives. Now, to get into Greek grammar weeds just a moment, the word for peace in Greek is eirene. Interestingly, there is a literal transliteration of that word into English in a word I don't hear very often, ironic. It's spelled E-I-R-E-N-I-C or I-R-E-N-I-C. And In Greek, the word can mean a variety of things: absence of war, out of danger, safe, living in harmony with order. It can apply to health. It, at least in one instance in the New Testament, the New Revised Standard Version translates it as salvation. It's used about 25 times in the New Testament. So for me, Sarah, it's, again, to use the word rich, there's a rich nuancing of the meaning. It doesn't just mean, you know, relax. It's full of assurance. You're safe. I'm here. And of course, he says it to disciples who are startled and terrified. And my dictionary and my desk translates or interprets ironic as conducive to peace, tending to conciliate or promote peace. So Jesus is saying this to very, very troubled people. Now, using modern day concepts, there's much made today about validating people's feelings, that feelings are neither right nor wrong. They just are. I don't hear Jesus invalidating their fear, but honoring it and offering a word of assurance to disciples who were very troubled. Now, there's an article by Jessica Mesman, is how I would pronounce her last name, M-E-S-M-A-N, the associate editor of the Christian Century, in an April 7, 2021 issue. She writes an article about her own trauma with the death of her mother when Jessica was a freshman in high school. And in the article, Sarah, she quotes a book by Joan Didion, The Year of Magical Thinking, in which Joan Didion talks about how totally disorienting her husband's death was. Joan describes herself as literally crazy with grief, and she characterizes her grief as obliterative. And Jessica Mesman says the disciples are terrified, as we would surely be if the dead stood before us. So I appreciated her empathy for the disciples. A risk here would be, well, why don't they get it? The Lord is there. But the Bible is not only honest about God and Jesus, it's about honest about the human experience. And so I felt this season a real empathy with the disciples. Thank you for the question.
What about you, John? What do you think about this greeting, peace be with you? Is it more than a standard greeting?
I think it's a wonderful greeting. I think it's real significant. The question for me, it comes to the chain in which we're hearing it. So we're reading an English translation, a word, and Jesus speaks it presumably in Aramaic, passes through Greek in between. And Aramaic is drawing from a deep Hebrew word. Is it shalom?
Yeah.
So that's my judgment as to the best Hebrew equivalent, which seems full of meaning to me. Jesus shows up and says, I think, in essence here, shalom for you. And in the context in which Bill, quoting the articles, has so hopefully described the trauma of their grief, I think that's a immediately helpful greeting to receive from a person who steps into the room. Shalom to you. And, of course, in John's gospel, unlike here in Luke's, in John's gospel, it's accompanied with breathing. And the way Luke describes this appearance and Jesus speaking there, that seems That seems to me to carry some of that in terms of the peace to be with you.
Thank you. I'm remembering how traumatizing it is to move through this sequence of, and I think the week of Easter, Holy Week, arriving at this point in our story, such conflicting emotional swings, the jubilation of entering Jerusalem, and then the instant confrontational clashing that happens in the overthrowing of the tables in the temple. And, you know, if things are, if my thinking about the order of things is actually what happened, there's just so much turbulence in the week up until this moment, with the sense of impending doom, the turbulence of torture, fear, denial, abandonment, guilt, crucifixion, numbness, shock, exhaustion, disbelief, hope, overwhelming hope, anxiety over seeing what seems unbelievable. In walking this path to Emmaus and then running back, only to encounter yet again a risen Christ. And this the statement of disbelieving in joy. And I think there's a wonderful suspension between, I don't know what I'm seeing. I want to see this. I don't know if it's true. I don't know if it's real. I think that it lands in the camp of, I think I would need somebody to help me stay in touch with reality. I would need somebody to bring me back down into the detail of things so that I would kind of have a place to be tethered, because I think I would be a little undone. I think I would need somebody to bring me peace. Mm. I think I would feel under threat. I would feel unsettled. I would feel distracted. I would feel scattered. All these things that I wonder that maybe the disciples are feeling too. And then that weird suspension or anxiety about, if this is indeed true, how is Jesus going to feel about me, having been one of the ones that scattered, or having been the one that denied him, or having been the one who walked away from the crucifixion going, wow, I thought this was going to go out such a different way. And how do you feel knowing that you've turned away from Christ to have Christ suddenly reappear? There's this suspension or this tension in the relationship too. So I thought about that. I think I would totally need that peace. And I think that this is an intentional and I would say a necessary moment that Christ has to say this out loud to them and go, what came before is before, and now we're here. And have him be able to undo all that tension, that confusion, that sense of anxiety. I see this greeting as a lot more than just the typical shalom or peace be with you statements that we see in the normal greeting pattern. I think this is also a metanoia, a place where the disciples turn from where they were and who they were before into somebody that has been instrumentally shifted. So I think they've gone through a fulcrum moment, and if you will, a turning now takes place that shifts the way that they're going to live the rest of their lives, part and parcel because of all the situational stuff that's happened, but also this forgiveness that comes in this greeting is, I think, dynamic. So I thought that was really an interesting thought, that this was a moment of turning away from who they were before toward who they're going to be. You know, the next bit of and I talked a little bit about this in the reading, is how significant it is for Jesus to eat. So what are your thoughts, John, about Jesus asking for and eating food?
You had said, Sarah, either in the recording or earlier, that you're drawn in the reading immediately to the almost British, it seems to me, question. Have you anything here to eat? And there's an engaging element about that text in that it seems so, other than what you expect the resurrected Christ to ask, it's early in his words to them. And of course, the community has a heightened sense of handling precious things, holy things, as it handles the memory of the first words that the resurrected Jesus spoke to his disciples together. And that the community remembers that mundane question, and the way in which Luke stakes it here, you know, reading in the English translation, it has a sense of politeness almost about it, but inquiry, you know, it's so other than the business of resurrection, he doesn't say, give me something to eat. He doesn't say, I'm hungry. You know, he asks a tad more for politeness sake, oblique, have you anything here to eat? The implication being, because if you do, I might like a little bite of it. So I'm intrigued by the specific emphasis of the phrase and the way it comes, because I think the ordinariness of it is part of what the memory of the community, Luke's memory, is holding on to for us. That that it was a very ordinary expression, and I'm suspecting that for them it was surprising as well. And all of that turns to the profound, mysterious, and rich enigma of what does a resurrected body involve. This is a body, like a human body, you know, such a heavy emphasis here on not being a ghost. Part of what we get from the community in memory is the memory, he wasn't a ghost. You know, it shows up two times, the word ghost here in this passage. Once with Jesus himself saying, I'm not a ghost. And that begs all kinds of questions for me about how are they using that word, ghost? But I think this question, have you anything here to eat, speaks to that issue. This is a resurrected body. It's like our bodies in its needs. A ghost wouldn't ask you, do you have something here to eat? But it's also a different body, a body of glory. It shows up in the room, you know, suddenly, moves over space and time quickly. So I think it's language that's meant to help the community understand how they were experiencing the resurrected body. And in that, it's speaking to what is Christian hope? What is Christian hope going forward?
Thank you. I get the impression Jesus might have been hungry. I think you're right. And Jesus is not a ghost, not a spirit, but flesh and blood, and in need of food, in need of company, in need of resolution. Some translations actually include that he asks for honey or honeycomb with the fish, which I thought was even more fun. The joyful and sweet meal in the company of friends is so much more than food, though, isn't it? It's kind of a sacred space into which we pour relationships. The disciples are given proof of the resurrection of a living, breathing, flesh and bones Christ who eats with them. And for me, that's just a nice way of resetting a memory. If the last memory you have is the crucified Christ, and now you have this, there's a totally different shift in how your brain captures that knowledge, and it resets the memory to something a whole lot more positive and a whole lot more hopeful. And so I love this idea of having a meal together again. And there's something joyful about that for me. What do you think, Bill?
Sarah, when I got your questions and I read this one for the first time, it resonated with me as the grandfather of three grandsons. The two oldest for a number of years lived in the same town as we nearby, and so they were often in our home. And you know what I'm about to say. Often when they walked in the door, Nana, you got anything to eat? And of course, Nana kept the refrigerator stocked with things they like to eat. And even as adults, they are a little more sophisticated, but it's not unusual. The oldest grandson who lives in this area to take him out to a meal. And after a 20-minute drive back home to our apartment, he walks to the refrigerator. So you resonated with the grandfather in me that delights in that experience. Food is, again, my favorite word of the morning, rich in meaning for us. And based on scripture, and for us as people of faith, it represents God's presence. The Lord's Supper is in remembrance of the Lord's presence and showing the Lord's saving death until he returns. You alluded to the Emmaus walk journey, which is the immediately preceding journey. That narrative ends, and then you read the next verse, that narrative ends with the two who met Christ on the road to Emmaus telling the other disciples that Jesus had been made known to them in the breaking of the bread. So it powerfully represents the presence, not only of physical nourishment, but the presence of God. And Jonathan Walton, in the Connections commentary in his article on this passage, refers to the other times Jesus fed people, the 5,000, the 4,000, the upper room experience. And he says the shared meal signifies Jesus's presence, intimacy, and communion. I like that. And then in John, the Gospel of John ends with the breakfast at the seashore at dawn story, which I and all fisher persons like. Now, several of the commentaries wondered, well, maybe this was just Jesus showing or trying to pretend. I don't think that. I think Jesus was fully human and that this is a genuine request based on Jesus as a fully human person needing nourishment. And we remember after the temptations in the desert early in his, what was the first thing that angels did? And if my memory is correct, they fed him. So thank you for this nurturing question, Sarah.
Can I do a follow-up, Sarah?
Sure.
Why? I've often wondered out of this, given the clarity, meaning the specificity of this memory, and given that it's matched by the other food, I think in any of the gospel witnesses, the only food the resurrected Jesus eats is fish, right?
Mm-hmm.
Checking that.
I think that's right.
Why is it in our Easter celebrations, fish is not the entree? I find I'm engaged with that with an energy that as I've asked folks about that this week or earlier as I work with this text, it's not something that they have the same energy about. But it intrigues me. You know, obviously, I'm wondering if this is true globally. The Easter meal, which as you all are so helpfully reminding us, is really connected to the fellowship and the festival, to say nothing of the Lord's Supper. Hmm. Why isn't the Easter festival meal for Christians fish? Since that's what the only thing the risen Lord eats, you know, is fish. It's lamb, right? Or it's ham, right? Mm-hmm. There's other articles written, you know, about that, you know, the implications of those things that we're eating and why and the history of why we're eating them, you know, or even eggs. But it's not fish. And I think we've got that wrong.
It may have more to do with it's locally sourced. I'm just curious about that. And what's easily available, it seems to me that these people would be resourceful as fishermen. They probably have a way of getting those resources better, faster than others. But I'm just thinking, you know, fishermen know fishermen. And they go, what do you have that's fresh and spare? And what can I have for this amount of money? And they would be able to gather fish pretty quickly. Or source it, if you will, on the beach, because it's what's locally available. So it's the first farm to table thing, I think, which is really awesome. So Jesus states that we are witnesses, that they are witnesses. And how is this visible in the church today? And so I guess I'm moving from how do we continue the story of the risen Christ. Janet Hunt shares that in her article, Dancing with the Word, from April 8th, and the article is entitled Living Power of Forgiveness. She asks, indeed, what if they had received their identity as witnesses, but never actually witnessed to what they'd all seen and heard? And how that would have dynamically changed the church as we understand it, if the story had stalled. Like Mary in the ending of the passage a couple of weeks ago, she was too afraid to say anything to anybody. I wonder about that. And how do we shift from being witnesses to witnessing to other people? And in my thinking, it was almost as if Jesus was astute at listening and seeing. And knowing when to react or respond or reach out to someone is a gift. And then seeing a need or a person in need, really, really seeing it instead of just going, I'm going to throw money at the problem, but seeing the person and hearing from them what they need. Sometimes I think the church offers to help and perhaps helping without even being asked, because we understand what it feels like to be thirsty. It feels like to be hungry. It feels like to be on the street. So I think that this intrinsic giving of time and talent to be a resource to others, I think is what I see the modern church doing. Sharing what we have, you know, I think that's the other thing I know. In my life experience has been when something happens that's catastrophe, the church is it becomes the source of rejuvenation or bringing people together and becomes that place in the community people can gather to distribute goods, to find resources, to see each other. Sometimes I think the church is really good at sticking with somebody. Sticking with somebody in times of uncertainty and grief and disagreement. I think that we're in that place in time now where we agree that what we believe is more valuable than our opinion. And I think that that's helpful as a witness, I think, especially right now. And working with resolution in mind, not to position an opinion and win the argument, but working toward a resolution that honors all parties. Caroline Lewis suggests that witnessing is a state of mind, or perhaps a posture or disposition by which we live. Caroline Lewis writes in workingpreacher.org, and what we do is not witness alone. We witness with the Holy Spirit. So we don't do it all by ourselves. And I think that that's helpful to me in how I see the church moving from witnesses to witnessing. What are your thoughts, Bill?
Sarah, I like to play with words. And it occurred to me this time that witness has a double meaning. at least in our vocabulary. It's what I see and experience, and also what I report. If I witnessed a crime and I'm a witness in court, I'm reporting what I have seen. So I found that helpful, that first of all, the disciples saw the Lord, and then they were commanded to tell others what they had seen. So I take your question in both senses. How do I witness the power of the Lord, and how do I share it? As a fourth generation Presbyterian, I grew up singing often the hymn, "We've a Story to Tell to the Nations," a triumphal song. And we as Presbyterians, at least in my experience, do not have a tradition of testifying, of sharing what God is doing in our lives and how we see God at work in the lives of other people. I've seen the power of witnessing both meanings of that in 12-step programs, in which people share their story. Now, they're coached not to dwell on the joy of the addiction, but the power of their higher power and their own choices to move toward the metanoia that you mentioned earlier, Sarah, the change of direction, making amends, seeking forgiveness, learning to love and live in a different way. So if you've ever been to a 12-step meeting, you see the power of the storytelling. Now, there's another kind of seeing, not seeing in the gospel, Matthew 25. When did we see you? And to your point, Sarah, it was when they fed the hungry, when they visited people in prison, clothed the naked. And then conversely, when did we not see you? In seminary, I'm forgetting his name, a famous preacher at the time preached on that passage. And the punchline at the end was, when you serve a person in need, you're not just being charitable, and you shouldn't say to yourself, "There but by the grace of God go I." You should instead say, "There goes Jesus Christ." That still is Velcroed in my mind. And then Caroline Lewis, in her Working Preacher article of April 12, 2015, makes a note that Mark Davis does. There's actually a verb missing in the Greek. It literally says, "You witnesses of these." John probably is better at Greek grammar than I. My memory of my classwork in college and seminary on Greek was, when it's not verb is not expressed, it's understood to be present. And not only understood, it's a more powerful way of saying it in a more compact way. So it's not, as Caroline Lewis says, you were, not you will be, but you are. And then what Jesus tells them to focus on is repentance and forgiveness of sins. And my last comment, for reasons I don't understand, and that yesterday on the Working Preacher podcast, they basically insisted that you should read the verse following where ours ended, which in the way it's presented in the New Revised Standard Version is part of the same narrative. And Jesus goes on to say, the Holy Spirit, he doesn't mention it by name, but he says, "I am sending upon you what my Father promised. So stay in the city until you have been clothed with power from on high." So my point is, it's not just in our own power, but Jesus promises a power beyond ourselves that will help us to fulfill that command to witness.
Thank you, Bill. John, what are your thoughts? How does the church move from witnessing, or being witnesses, to being the witnessing group?
I note, as Bill did, the way the lectionary scholars in the pericope, in a way that the English translation and the Greek text don't, in that they choose to end it with that verse 48, as opposed to what the text itself, in terms of location, what are the limits of the pericope? One of the cues to the limits of the pericope is always a location change. Location change occurs in verse 50, that he led them out as far as Bethany. So there's not, this verse the lectionary scholars leave out, stands out there orphaned if you don't include it in this pericope. It's the last words of Jesus in that room. So it's an intentional choice on their part. And I do think that's important to note as we think about what Jesus said. Having said that, I really like it. For the purposes of working together in our gatherings on Sundays and Eastertide, I think it heightens the impact of the message to the people there hearing it in those gatherings on Sundays. To us, there's a twofold movement here. I think one is in this saying, "You are witnesses." One is saying, everyone who hears or reads these words is engaged with that moment, the moment of resurrection. And then it's not just they that are witnesses. We are now pulled into that witnessing while we have been witnesses through our ears, at least in terms of what we heard of that specific moment. We are those who have experienced the moment, and so we become witnesses to it. And we become part of those who are retelling it and become witnesses in it. So I think it's a declaration that pulls the hearer into the community that identifies with experiencing the resurrected Christ. And then as an exhortation to the church, the larger church, I think that we make that witness, which in terms of if they put in the further last verse, 49, it has a sense of sending in it. I'm sending upon you what my Father promised, meaning the Spirit. But as the lectionary gives it to us here, you're just witnesses. That seems to me the church does that in two ways, through proclamation. And that proclamation is the work that you all are leading us in so faithfully right here, that we remember the moment, that we talk about the moment, that we declare it. And the church does that principally in its gathering on Sundays and reading these texts out loud, right? That we become proclaimers of what happened there at that time. If we stopped doing that, it would wither away pretty quickly, save for the sustaining work of the Spirit. But that's how it exists over 2,000 years, is by the church handling these holy things and reading them and saying them, and then all of the reflection. And then our life together, our shared life together, is a proclamation in and of itself. So I think that more so than the individual is looking for people who we think we need to declare this to as sharing within the witness. I believe, of course, that happens. I mean, I've experienced that and I've done that. But the largest way in which it seems to me the church has done this is by our shared life together and our formal declaration, particularly in Sabbath worship, of what these things are, what happened.
I'm going to put a footnote on that, and it's how we love each other. I think that's demonstrative in how we come together. Anybody want to add anything else?
Just a thank you for the question, Sarah.
So this podcast is made possible by Palmacia Presbyterian Church, which is located at 3501 West San Jose in Tampa, Florida. For more information, you can visit the website www.palmacia.org, and that's PALMACEIA.org. And at that site, you'll find lots to learn about our church community, about the outreach that we do, how we engage our families and what we're doing in the traditional contemporary worship services, wonderful sermons, beautiful music, a variety of Christian education and fellowship opportunities to engage in. So we commend that site to you, and you're always welcome. And we'll see you next time.